Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Aaron Weinach. I'm here with New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. And today we're talking with Don Ostrowski, and specifically we're discussing his new book on Europe, Byzantium, and the Intellectual Silence of Rus Culture. So thanks for being with us, Don.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So could you start off by giving us a little background on who you are, where you teach, what got you interested in Russian history, where you went to school, things of that nature?
Well, I can begin. My chief claim to fame is I was born in the same hospital that Taylor Swift was born in. West Reading, Pennsylvania. Of course, we were different generations, so we had different gynecologists. I'm a big fan of hers, but she's never heard of me. So there you are. I grew up in Reading, Pennsylvania, and wound up my freshman year at college. I went to Howard University in Washington, D.C. My sophomore year, I went to what was then called Kutztown State College, which is north of Reading. And then for my junior and senior years, I went to University of California, Berkeley, where I got my bachelor's degree. Subsequently, I taught secondary school, elementary school. And that experience teaching secondary and elementary school convinced me that I did not want to become a secondary or elementary school teacher. I wanted to become a college teacher. So I went to, I was still in California at the time. I went to San Francisco State, got my master's degree, and then came back to Pennsylvania, to Penn State, to get my PhD, which was very fortuitous for me, because right at the same time, scholar by the name of Sergei Vasilyevich Utyekin was hired at Penn State. And he had had a rather interesting career. He was born, raised in the Soviet Union, but during World War II, got caught up in this displaced persons and wound up in Kiel, Germany, where he had gone to Moscow State University and had experienced people like S.O. Schmidt and others. But wound up at Kiel and got a degree there and then went to England for a number of years, knew Isaiah Berlin and various other people. He wrote a history of Russian political thought and then wound up at Penn State just at the time when I got there. And I consider him to be my mentor. He's the one who really, before then, I love studying history. Written papers for courses, research papers, and so thought I was pretty good. And he made me realize, no, I really didn't. I didn't know the methodology. And that is something that's essential. So that his teaching of methodology was really what gave me a way to approach the subject matter rather than just read a lot and write a lot. There was actually a purpose, a method to what the way I was approaching it. So when it came time to do my dissertation, I got interested in this topic through one of his seminars on early Muscovite, early Rus history on the Church Council of 1503. But of course, Penn State did not have the library support for that. It's a very good library, but it's geared more for modern studies. And also, he felt that he wasn't the appropriate person to give me the guidance I needed to do a dissertation on that topic. So another professor there, George Entine, wrote to a friend of his at Harvard, who taught at Harvard, a fellow by the name of Edward L. Keenan, and said, what do we do with this guy? He wants to do this dissertation on 16th century Muscovy, and we're kind of stuck with him. So Ned said, well, send him up here. I'll make sure I take care of him. I'll get him access to the library. What Keenan did for me was kind of a second mentor. He included me in the weekly meetings with his graduate students. And in the spring of that year, that was in 1973-74, he turned over his graduate seminar, which had 10, 12 students in it, to looking at the issues surrounding the 1503 Church Council. I mean, who could ask for a greater gift than this, than to have 10 or 12 graduate students writing papers on your dissertation topic?
Yes, that would be nice.
Yes. So when I went to the Soviet Union to do research the following year, I was loaded. I knew exactly what I wanted to look at, what I wanted to, the questions I was asking of the materials. But even so, it was a bit of a surprise to me when I got there to do the research on the manuscripts, because up to that point, I had assumed that the published editions and most of the sources I was using were published, not all, but most, that they were accurate representations of the manuscripts. And just as a kind of afterthought, I said, well, I think I'll just check to see how they do this, more to learn how to edit a source from a manuscript. And then I said, well, wait a minute, what it says here in the published version, that's not what's in the manuscript. They changed something here, and they didn't say anything. It was kind of a tacit changing of things. Now, granted, most of the changes were not, you know, significant content-wise, but there were some, and some of the changes in the published version over what the manuscript copies said did mislead. On occasion, did mislead scholars. That led me to go back over all of the published versions, check all of the manuscript copies, as many as I could. I couldn't get to all of them for various reasons. One of them I didn't get to until 15 years later. It was in Novosibirsk, and my rukovoditel, Rusin Skrinnikov, said, well, I can't justify your going to Novosibirsk for one manuscript. Well, when one is a codicologist, as I was felt I was developing into, you go to the ends of the earth for one manuscript. So I managed to get back to the Soviet Union, 1989, and on a tourist visa, and put in that I was going to Novosibirsk, and finally saw that manuscript. And there's a whole other story involved with that. But the upshot was that I did finish the dissertation in the 1970s before I saw that manuscript. But in the meantime, when I was at Harvard, I started attending an informal seminar that was included Ned Keenan, Ihor Shevchenko, Emelyan Pritsak, and Horace Lunt. And for people in the field, these are, you know, like the superstars. And they would meet once a week with assorted graduate students, postdocs, anybody who wanted to attend, to discuss the Rus' Primary Chronicle, Povest Vremeni Klet. And Horace Lunt was doing a translation of it. And he was doing it on the fly. A week ahead, he would type up a couple pages of translation. And the rule was that at least for the top four primary investigators, they would not look at Samuel Cross's translation. They wanted to do a translation anew without any influence from Cross. When Lunt would type up these pages, he would hand them out to all of us a week before, then we'd have a week to go over it. And we would rarely get more than half a page at the next set, through a half a page at the next session, because they were going over every word, every phrase, bringing in all sorts of arcane knowledge, making comparisons. And in itself, that seminar, that weekly seminar, was an education. It went on for many years. The Lunt finally finished the translation. It hasn't been published yet. He completed it. Well, almost 40 years. It's due to come out, but one of the problems with it was that he tried to do it. The transition to English was not all that readable. It was accurate in terms of representing what the Russian language was, but it didn't. And he kept saying that he would go back over it and polish it up and make it readable. He did not completely succeed before he died. But in the meantime, I noticed something about their, since I had developed this habit of going back to the manuscripts, I started comparing. They were translating from Dmitry Likhachev's Russian edition of the Povest Vremeni Klet. And I went back and looked at the published versions of the manuscripts, and noticed that there were problems with Likhachev's text. He was not accurately representing the manuscripts. And so I wrote it up in a memo. At first, Keenan was supportive. Shevchenko was dismissive at first. But then when I brought in more evidence, they all agreed that we needed a new edition of the PVL. And they said, Don, you're the person to do it. And I said, I don't think so. I'm just kind of a hanger on here. I'm a fly on the wall, and I just happened to notice something because of my experience with the manuscripts in the Soviet Union. So they said, well, no, we want you to do this new edition. So I spent a number of years working on it. It finally did come out in 2003 or something and like that. But being at Harvard, I would joke, you know, I was early on, I was trying to get out of Harvard. I was trying to get a job, a real job, teaching at a college or university someplace, as my colleagues were. And so I was applying all over the place. Anything that came up that looked halfway that I could qualify for, like New Zealand, I applied to Jamaica, Elon College, North Carolina, just everything. And I would get rejected. I wouldn't even get to interviews. So I don't know if it was my dissertation topic that was put offing. So I would joke that Harvard was the only place that would hire me.
Yeah, I was having a similar thought there when you were saying that.
So it was a blessing in disguise because I got to be close to Widener Library my entire career. And Widener Library, for those of people who don't know of it, it is a scholarly heaven. it's just wonderful. You're reading something in some article or book, and they cite some obscure work, and we used to go to the card catalog. Now we go to Hollis, look it up. There it is. It's in Widener Library, sitting on the shelf, waiting for you to come. It hasn't been used in 30 years, and there it is. I also say that the reason I'm here in Cambridge is because of Widener Library, which there's a certain element of truth to that. But long story short, pulling back to where we, the purpose of this interview, in the 1990s, well, late 1980s, 80s, 90s, a fellow by the name of Francis Thompson was doing some meticulous, exquisite work on early Rus texts, sources, magnificent linguistic work, really quite good. However, he would write these very detailed articles that, just chock full of information and brilliant insights and so forth. And at the end, he would throw off this statement like, the Russians were backward because of the church. And it just took people aback because in the field, that's not a value judgment we make. We make plenty of other value judgments, but not that the church held things back. The alternative to that is some other scholars would say, well, no, it was the Mongols. The Mongols held things. They cut off Rus from Europe, and that's what held them back. Neither of those, I think, supported with the evidence, but it's how does one explain the fact that Europe, Western Europe, especially in Italy, France, England, really took off in the Middle Ages intellectually, But Eastern Europe, including given principalities, the Muscovy, did not. How does one explain that? So that's what led to the writing of this particular book. I will say this, in addition, I was hired at the Harvard Extension School in 1982 to teach courses. And that's kind of an adjunct position at the time. It was a yearly contractual agreement. But then in 1988, they hired me to a regular position as research advisor, advising in a master's program. Master of Liberal Arts program. And I advised social science students, history, political science, international relations, medieval studies, and so forth. But as a result of both my experience with the master's students at Harvard Extension School, and they're allowing me to teach a four-semester world history sequence, it allowed me to think more about the relationship of Russian studies, early Russian studies, Ukrainian studies, Rus studies, to the rest of the world, to histories that were going on elsewhere in the world. And before then, I would say that I didn't completely have the blinders on as to what was going outside of my particular specialty. But my specialty was my main focus. To give you an example, when I did my dissertation, I would say I was obsessed. For 4 years, I saw the world through the prism of the 1503 Church Council.
Well, you have to. That's the only way you get finished.
And it, for me, it was a labor of love. But when I finished the dissertation, and this is very interesting, I got a part-time job teaching at Boston College. And as enjoyable as it was working on my dissertation, I felt suddenly liberated because now I could read Dickens. I didn't have to worry that reading Tale of Two Cities was taking me away from working on my dissertation. So basically the whole world opened up. The other aspect of that is that you may have had this experience. I don't know. Some people have. As a graduate student, one knows everything. Reading the scholars in the field, and you can see where they made mistakes. So you feel that you're really very knowledgeable about things. it's a very limited knowledge, but you're not aware of that at the time because you're feeling quite proud of yourself. But then when you get your PhD and you have to go out and teach, suddenly you realize you're not as smart as you thought you were. you have to teach things you don't know anything about, and you have to learn them very quickly. Keenan once used the phrase, the shark-eating undergraduates. I think that applies. You're facing the students who are saying, okay, Professor Ostrowski, teach me something. Teach me something I don't know. Oh, dear. Well, you want to know about a manuscript from the 16th century? The other, and I'll just mention this briefly. The other aspect was that I went through, along with that beginning to teach part of it, where I suddenly realized I didn't know as much as I thought I did, was that the whole, I basically went through a crisis of, I guess one could call it a methodological crisis, because yes, I had, you know, Utekin had really instilled in me the importance of methodology. But once I finished the dissertation, I said, well, you know, I could, theoretically, I could turn around and write an anti-dissertation. I could write a refutation of my own dissertation, because I knew the weak spots, you know, where the evidence was, you know, not so sound. And I said, well, is that what historical study is about? You write something, you argue a case, and then somebody else argues against you. And I said, well, no, but what really is it? And then that led me into really delving into not just historical methodology, but methodology overall. In particular, reading people like Karl Popper, and the whole idea of formulating of research questions, hypotheses, and testing those hypotheses, so that one is not arguing a case, one is examining, investigating the evidence, and whatever assertions that one reads or one makes oneself, one tests it against the evidence. So every assertion becomes provisional, tentative, dependent on new evidence or a different way of looking at the old evidence or a different logical argument. And it creates a sense of insecurity, but for me, it really is the only intellectually honest way to approach it. I'm not a lawyer, you know, prosecuting a case or defending a client. I'm an investigator, a detective. I'm more Sherlock Holmes, trying to solve a puzzle. And if my solution isn't correct, well, that's okay, because I can change my solution dependent on new evidence or a better way of explaining the present evidence. So that brings me to Europe, Byzantium, and the intellectual science of Rus' culture, because I knew Francis Thompson. I had gone to talks with his, and he would say in his talks, well, you know, where was the Russian Peter Abelard? And I said, well, you know, that maybe not the right question to ask. And then his response was, well, they didn't have Plato, did they? And it was that kind of dismissive, flippant, interpreted by me, not only me, but response that really got me started what was initially supposed to be an article, that I was going to try to explain what was the why it is that Rus' culture was intellectually silent, and that goes back to the Father Georges Florovsky, who published an article in Slavic Review about that. And Florovsky was someone who was a great admirer of early Rus' culture, but he acknowledged that, you know, he wouldn't have couched it in terms of where was the Russian Peter Abelard, but he acknowledged that, you know, Western Europe, medieval Western Europe, was a hotbed of intellectual thought. There were people arguing back and forth, theological concerns, and they were bringing in the logic of Aristotle. They were influenced heavily by that time, by the High Middle Ages, by Plato and so forth. And then there's Scholasticism. Well, where is the equivalent in Rus history, in early Rus history? And the answer is there isn't. There is an equivalent. And then the question becomes why? Thompson's answer was the church held Rus back. And other people say it was the Mongols. And some people say it's a combination of the two. Both the church and the Mongols held them back. Well, that seemed to me not to be such a good answer. I felt that there had to be a better answer.
It's certainly quite teleological.
Well, yes, and the other aspect of this is also the way Russian history is approached in general, and I have been aware for some time that there. Modernist, post-Petrine. There's a traditional divide in Russian history with Peter the Great, and the general notion is, and it has been expressed in print by various scholars, that basically anything before Peter is not worth knowing. It's superstition. It's obscurantism, it's darkness and backwardness. And then Peter brings Russia into the modern age, kicking and screaming into the modern age. And then everything is, Russia at post-Peter is now part of the mainstream of European culture, type of thing, more or less. I had begun my graduate studies, with European history. I got my master's degree in European history and moved further east when I got into the PhD program at Penn State, studying 19th century Russian history. I got interested in 19th century Russian history at San Francisco State, where Peter K. Christoph was teaching. So I thought I wanted to do 19th century Russian intellectual history of some kind. And Utekin would have been perfect for that. I mean, except I got this notion I wanted to do a dissertation on 16th century church council. So I kind of understood the view of modernists in Russian history, because there's a whole lot going on with Peter's reign and after Peter's reign. And when I made that switch back to studying the 16th century in particular, I had to relearn a lot. And as Keenan would say, anything written in English is probably wrong about that period. But then when I would look at Peter's reign from the viewpoint of earlier, I was not seeing a great deal that he had changed. He was given credit for changing a lot. I wasn't seeing pre-Petrine Russia as this obscurantist, superstitious, backward culture. But I was seeing antecedents to what occurred in Peter's reign and in the 18th century. And eventually I wrote up an article trying to make the case that we should look at the 18th century as more a unit with 17th and 16th century Russian history, rather than putting it in the category with 19th century Russian history. That article, of course, fell flat. People in the field don't want to hear that. So I do feel that I have an appreciation for earlier Rus culture that maybe people who focus on the post-Petrine period it's not that they don't have an appreciation for it, it's that they don't really think about it. Because what we were taught and what's in the textbooks is that things only really get started with Peter. There are icons and certain things, but it's only that window on the west, St. Petersburg, and bringing Russia into the orbit of European history, that then that's what's worth studying. When someone like Francis Thompson was saying, well, the church held Rus back, then it kind of goes against that, the notion that this whole period, this earlier history, is something that not only is worth studying on its own, which Thompson certainly did, but it informs us about Peter's reign and the post-Petrine period. It increases our appreciation for what comes later, precisely because it's not just backward obscurantism and superstition, that there is a whole lot going on there that is worthwhile for anyone studying Russian history or Ukrainian history to really know about. And so that pretty much brings us up to this book we're supposed to be discussing today.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So the question, and I took it as Thompson's assertion, where was the Russian Peter, or his question, where was the Russian Peter Abelard, as a challenge to was subsequently asked by Fedotov, why Paris and not Kiev? Paris was in the 11th and 12th centuries, was a hotbed of intellectual thought. And it was this issue of the Neoplatonic construct in terms of theology. Theology was a crown jewel of disciplined studies. And the views were on one extreme, Bernard of Clairvaux, who said, one understands through one's soul, through tears and suffering. That's how one understands the divine soul, through one's own soul to the divine soul. The people like Abelard were not so much into tears and suffering, although Abelard suffered misfortunes, but they wanted to understand this at an intellectual level. And what was happening in Western Europe at the time was an influx of texts coming in across the Pyrenees from Toledo, from the Muslim Spain, Andalusia, that the Christians were, when they took Toledo, they found a storehouse of Arabic texts, that many of which were translations from the Greek, translations of Plato and Aristotle that Europeans north of the Pyrenees did not have. What they had was Neoplatonic thought, and they might have had part of one of Plato's writings. They had virtually nothing of Aristotle. Everything was secondhand. And now, with the fall of Toledo, those Arabic texts were being translated into Latin. The Arabic translations from Greek were being translated into Latin. And now they could get Plato firsthand through this process of translation. And for many of the thinkers, it was quite eye-opening. There was a period of pushback by the church against the use of, well, dialectic in particular, but use of critical thinking toward theological matters. If Bernard of Clairvaux is correct that the way to true understanding of the divine is through tears and suffering and prayer and so forth, then there is no room for analysis. There's no room for dividing things into this and that and for the use of dialectic. Were people who were starting to use dialectic to apply in France and England and Italy. They were starting to use dialectic to question things. Just the entire question of transubstantiation. During the Eucharist, when the priest holds up the host and holds up the chalice with the wine in it, does that bread, host, change really into the body of Christ? And does the wine really change into the blood of Christ? Even though it still appears to be bread and wine to our human selves. Now, in a Neoplatonic construct, there's no problem with that. because this world is a world of illusion. And while we think it's bread, that's a delusion, because it is really the body of Christ, okay, that we are partaking of in communion. Well, people like Berengarius of Tours or Rosellenus of Compiègne, they were saying, well, wait a minute. there's something that doesn't quite make sense with that. And they were trying to figure this out. Well, the church was pushing back. No, 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 don't apply things of this world to theological matters. So in the middle of that is when Peter Abelard shows up, and he's, you know, a dialectician par excellence, at least according to his own account. He was besting everybody in disputation.
Sort of like your beginning graduate student, as I recall.
Yes, he was he could not be accused of lack of confidence. Bernard did not like, personally did not like what Abelard was doing, called him a new theologian, which is a term of derision. Now we tend to think of new as good, you know, new improved. Well, for the Middle Ages, anything new was wrong, because all of truth had already been revealed. Okay, so if it was new, it was not true. So calling him a new theologian was basically calling a fake theologian. So Abelard did get into some trouble for his views. He was called to two councils, Sassoon and Sens, but he was not declared a heretic. Basically, what happened, because the church looked at his views in askance, not a lot of people picked up on him, at least in the surface, outwardly. So by the next century, by the 13th century, he was pretty much forgotten in Western Europe. And it was only with the discovery of the letters between him and Heloise that he then comes back as, you know, these star-crossed lovers, and he gets castrated and she goes into a convent and this type of thing. And it was only hundreds of years later, beginning late Enlightenment and definitely in the 19th century, that Abelard became seen as the champion of, you know, intellectual thought, of inquiry, of freedom of thinking. But nonetheless, there were those, what was happening, in part because of Abelard, but in part despite him, was the church, some churchmen were already beginning to adopt dialectical thought. Dialectic, and here maybe I should explain, it's part of the seven liberal arts, trivium and quadrivium, which was the curriculum in schools in medieval Europe, and the trivium was grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic. We call it logic. And the quadrivium was arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. So one could look at the trivium as the expression of ways of persuading people through grammar and rhetoric and logic, and the quadrivium were numbers, arithmetic being numbers in themselves, geometry being numbers taking shape, astronomy being numbers in motion, and music being numbers in relationship to each other, type of thing. So all of this was going on in medieval Western Europe, and those who were beginning to use dialectic, incorporating dialectic into the church's theological reasoning, like Anselm with his ontological proof for the existence of God, Thomas Aquinas, they were using dialectic in a way to corroborate conclusions that had already been reached through matters of faith. Their guiding principle basically was, yes, we'll use dialectic to defend the theology if dialectic does, if in using dialectic we come to a conclusion that's different from the theological extent theological views, then it's dialectic that's wrong, not the theology. In counter to that were those who were saying, perhaps if we reach conclusions on the basis of dialectic and it doesn't agree with theology, maybe the theology is wrong. So you can see that this would create quite a tension going on in Western Europe. And the eventually a compromise of sorts was reached after strikes at university in Paris and so forth by the students, whereby Plato was used for matters of the divine, and Aristotle was used for matters of this world. And matters of the divine in this construct were superior to matters of this world. So Plato was superior to Aristotle. But the dialecticians, the people who were using dialect, people like William of Ockham, for example, they couldn't help but question this notion that dialectic should be subsumed entirely to theology, as Thomas Aquinas was doing. Okay, so that's the Western medieval European view of things. Well, what about Byzantium? What was going on in Byzantium? Well, something very interesting was going on roughly the same time. There were Byzantine thinkers who had, they knew Aristotle, they knew Plato. Well, they knew compendiums. Not sure how much of the direct writings of Aristotle and Plato they had, but people like Michael Psellos. But one of them was John Attalus, who became the head philosopher in Constantinople. And he, like Abelard, loved to best people in disputation. He was using dialectic, to beat people over the head and beat them into submission. Well, this did not sit well with the Patriarch of Constantinople. And the Patriarch and the Emperor were very close. And eventually, there were a number of trials of the followers of John Attalus, basically squashing this whole dialectical movement in Byzantium. So it never really developed. Don't know if it could have developed the way it did in France, let's say, in Paris. But the authorities were not about to give it a chance of doing so in Byzantium. But how does that relate to Rus? And that was the question that Francis Thompson, as I took Francis Thompson's question about where was the Russian Peter Abelard, or Fedotov's question, why Paris and not Kiev? And part of the answer that I came up with first of all, when Rus was Christianized, 988, Volodymyr I, sends the people of Kiev en masse into the Dnieper River to be baptized. And Christianity spreads throughout Rus with official sanction now of the Prince of Kiev. What did Rus get from Byzantium? And this is something Thompson had basically pointed out. What they got was the equivalent of the library of a large Byzantine monastery. That is, he provided an example of this, and I checked. I found the library catalog for that monastery in around that time, and indeed, there's a correlation between what was in that monastery and what was available to the Rus in the 11th and 12th centuries in terms of texts that were being translated into Rusyn. Well, why was that? Well, because it was the monks in Bulgaria who were tasked with providing the information to this newly Christianized area of the world, Rus, that the people of Rus needed for the salvation of their souls. So basically liturgical texts, the Psalter, some books of the Bible, Genesis and Exodus, the Gospels, things that they could use in church services, efficatory writings, saints' lives. So things that were for the soul, that is, looking at it from the Neoplatonic viewpoint, the soul was all important. So and these texts were not meant to introduce new knowledge to the soul, but to unlock knowledge that was already there. Okay. So these were the keys to one's understanding the divine. Well, okay, so where is Plato? Where is Aristotle? Where is Sophocles? Where is Euripides? Pythagoras? Well, that's not necessary. I'm recreating now what I figured was the thinking of the prelates who made this decision. It wasn't necessary for them to know these things. For what purpose? That's not going to help save their souls, which is the primary purpose of Christianizing them. Besides that, even if they thought, these prelates in Bulgaria thought that it was necessary for the people of Rus to have Aristotle and Plato and so forth, that kind of influx that occurred in the 11th century in Western Europe from Toledo of Aristotle and Plato texts, they probably would not have utilized them the same way because, and this was an issue that I encountered some pushback by Byzantine scholars. I am not convinced, I have not seen sufficient evidence that dialectic, one of the seven liberal arts, which was a standard part of the curriculum in medieval Western Europe, that dialectic was part of the curriculum, school curriculum in Byzantium. I'm not saying that there weren't scholars, there weren't people like Psellos who were John of Damascus. People were aware, but it wasn't taught. At least I haven't seen evidence, sufficient evidence of that. So even if the seven liberal arts had been transferred from Byzantium to Rus, it probably would not have included dialectic. And dialectic, as the cover of the book, has a photo of a wood carving that one can find at the Hall of Peace in Munster, Germany. And as I was finishing up writing the book, my wife and I were in Munster, and I went to the Hall of Peace, and they have these wood carvings of the seven liberal arts, and there was dialectica. And I said, that would make a great cover for the book, because it seems to me that presence or absence of dialectic teaching was a crucial element in the difference between what happened first in medieval Western Europe on one hand, and what happened in Byzantium and Rus on the other. Now, one could say, you're putting too much emphasis on just this one discipline. Oh, yes, they had dialectic in Byzantium and so forth and so on. But the truth of the matter is they did not have it in Rus. And the question is why? And then one could say, well, so what? So what if they didn't have dialectic? They could still have, made the effort to acquire Plato and Aristotle. Well, it goes beyond that. It's not that they didn't have dialectic. It became an opposition to dialectic, an opposition in some respects to the seven liberal arts, that these were tools of the devil. These were ensnarements in things of this world. And one could learn them to kind of defend oneself against them, or just not risk the temptation by not learning them at all, just divorcing oneself. Now, in the forum that was in Russian History Journal, there was a really excellent article by Rob Romanchuk about grammar in medieval Rus. And as I pointed out in my response in that forum, David Goldfrank has written quite a bit on Josef Volodsky's use of rhetoric in 16th century Muscovy. But the dialectic was not part of that. You can kind of find isolated examples, Kirill Bielizarsk Monastery in the middle of the 15th century, for example. But it just was not part of their way of approaching theological matters. So that was my attempt at an explanation that involved not just focusing on the Mongols, not just focusing on the Rus Church, but looking at it in a cross-cultural way. Why Paris and not Kiev? Why was there a Russian Peter Abelard at all? Kind of reversing, not why wasn't there, a Russian Peter Abelard, but why was there a French Peter Abelard? Try to get a deeper understanding of what was going on in these Christian cultures that they had so much in common, but yet intellectually went in different directions.
I had a interesting chat some time ago for this podcast with John Givens on a book he wrote about Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Pasternak. Givens makes quite a bit of the conviction, which you also bring up in your book, about God as being unknowable except in a negative, apophatic sense. I was wondering, do you think that this difference you've identified in the book over the use of dialectical inquiry, do you think that, does that proceed from the prior conviction that God is fundamentally unknowable, or do you think that the rejection of dialectic in the East is itself what results in the conviction that God is unknowable? I'm asking you, I guess, kind of a chicken and egg type question here.
Yeah, I think it's a chicken. I think it began with the apophatic, God is unknowable, and the Western Church also began with that notion. I think I pointed out in the book that there you can find examples in both Eastern and Western churches that the way to communion with God is through intellectual silence, through silence. That's why monasteries had rules about silence. but dialecticians are not silent. Dialecticians talk and they argue and they split differences and they make distinctions. Okay, that's fine for the Aristotelian part of this world. But then when it starts to go into the Platonic theological matters, that's when the church authorities get their backs up. Because then the apophatic part becomes chipped away at. One of the distinctions I see anyway between Eastern Church theology and Western Church theology is that Western Church theology has kind of incorporated this dialectical reason. They've reached an accommodation with it. And you can see this with the Jesuits. A reason why there's a term Jesuitical reasoning. and that goes directly back to dialectic. The Eastern Church, there are no Jesuits because the emphasis is on the unity of it all. So to divide things up not only goes against, the theology of the matter, it goes against the faith. In the Eastern Church, and to a certain degree in the Western Church, don't want to make too sharp a distinction, but there is a difference. In the Eastern Church, it's the experience that, I want to say, feeds the soul and leads to a communion with the divine. In the Western Church, there is that too. You can plenty of examples of that, but there's also a notion that one can approach it intellectually with analytical reasoning. And why is that? Why is analytical reasoning to a certain degree acceptable in the Western Church, but really it's not, has not been in the Eastern Church? And I think it does go back to different flavors of Neoplatonism, the different ways that, Augustine, for example, who was essential for amalgamating Neoplatonist thought with Christian theology, was not accepted very much in the Eastern Church. I think the translations into Greek of Augustine occurred very late, 14th century or so. Why? Why was Augustine accepted and highly praised in the Western Church, but not in the Eastern Church? And I think that's more chicken and egg. And basically that's the limit that I reached. I could not go any further in my investigation because I just don't know.
I think we got time for one more question here. And something that occurred to me as when I was reading your book is it so if Russian culture discovered dialectic, if it wasn't in the period you're talking about in the book? And, you know, as I was thinking about that, I was thinking that perhaps the 19th century might be the best candidate. You were saying earlier you saw quite a few continuities through Peter's reign with the pre-Peter period that some other historians do. So I'm just wondering what you think about that idea. I mean, is there a point at which we can say that dialectic was in fact discovered, or is that even a useful question to ask?
Well, it's a useful question, but from the Eastern Church's point of view, it never really. No, I'm open to contradiction on this, but as far as I'm aware, it never really became part, or has never really become part of the. Of the ways of theology in the Eastern Church. But knowledge about what was going on or what had gone on in Western Europe does come in the 18th century, 19th century, into Russia in terms of things of this world. And that leads into, that's already when secularization is coming to the fore. So there is now a place in Russian intellectual thought for analytical reasoning, but at a secular, in the secular realm than in the theological realm. And yes, I think Dostoevsky is a fascinating example of this. Some people have called him a philosopher who wrote his philosophy in fiction, novels and short stories. He was thinking through these issues, many of these issues. What does it mean to be a genuine Christian in a secular age? I regret that he didn't get to complete his trilogy, his proposed trilogy of Brothers Karamazov. But there is enough there in what we do have of his to see the way his thinking was going on that issue.
I've long thought of the scene where Alyosha simply kisses his brother in the cafe as being its own kind of apophatic theology, where we've defined God by silence rather than by, you know, analytical explanation or reasoning.
Yes, and when Father Zosima bows down to Dmitri. And Alyosha said, well, why did you do that? It's because of the suffering he's going through. Well, suffering in right. The Neoplatonic Bernard of Clairvaux view, that's the way to divine.
So summing up here, since we're about out of time, do you think it'd be fair to say that your overall argument here is that the reason we think Rus culture was silent wasn't because it was actually silent, but because it was speaking, I think the word you used was on a different frequency. Yeah. That seemed fair enough?
Yes, and icons are very important. The various compendia of quotations, sayings from the Bible and holy writings, saints' lives, all of these are not intellectually silent. They may, to the outsider, they may appear boring or, well, so what, kind of has that kind of reaction. But once you get into them, you at least one thinks, one sees quite a lot of intellectual thought, thinking going on, not dialectical, to be sure. But it is not silent. There are tons of things that are written. There are tons of icons that, by the late 15th, early 16th century, many of the icons needed handbooks to explain to the viewer what was in the icon. They were so complex. So yes, Rus was intellectually silent in terms of, in contrast to Western Europe. And the idea in Western Europe, intellectual became almost a synonymous with critical of the existing structure of things, at a secular level. So if one was just supportive of the monarch or the establishment, as we used to say in the 60s, that wasn't considered intellectual. Intellectual, you had to be critical. Well, in the Eastern Church, no, that was not acceptable to be critical of things. So there were other outlets for this intellectual activity. And the point being that we should look at Western Europe, medieval Western Europe, as an anomaly, not as a standard by which to judge other cultures. In many ways, it was a unique singularity. And once one has a broader perspective of what else was going on in world history at the time, the more it stands out as an oddity, with an oddity that developed into, among other things, the scientific revolution, the Enlightenment, modern secular age, but an anomaly nonetheless.
Well, thank you, Don. That's a pretty, there's a lot of food for thought in that final thought you offered up there. So I'll certainly be kicking that over myself in future. So thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks, Aaron. Thanks for letting me go on and on.
Oh, you bet. Bye now.
Bye.